Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. Well, today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the big stories in science and politics. The big story, of course, revolves around the coronavirus vaccine. So far, so good. Millions of people have been vaccinated already with minimal side effects. There have been some instances, but not enough to alter the trajectory of the vaccine. However, it also raises questions about how long does this immunity last? And are there new strains of the virus which may be resistant to the vaccine? Not just the UK version, which is getting a lot of attention, but there's a new mutation, a new variation coming out of South Africa, which may, just may, be able to evade the vaccine. And this is causing a tremendous shiver to go through scientific circles as we try to figure out whether or not a new strain of the virus is emerging out of South Africa, which is immune to the vaccine. Also, on the political front, we have to say a few things about Iran. Well, as you know, President Donald Trump put a hold on the treaty with Iran. The future is now up in the air. The Iranian government has stated that it has no restrictions on where it will go with regards to making an atomic bomb. And to make good on its threat, it has announced that 20% enrichment is the new target. And the question is 20% enrichment sufficient to develop an atomic bomb? And for that matter, if it isn't, then how long will it take to go from 20% to 90% bomb-grade material? So what are the pros and cons of the situation with regards to Iran? And also, dark matter is in the news. It turns out that, well, most astronomers believe that dark matter is a new form of matter that we don't see here on the planet Earth. However, there's a renegade theory that says that, no, our models are wrong. Our theory is wrong. Gravity does not obey the laws of Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein. And they cite new materials, new data, that seem to indicate that, well, maybe it's true. So we'll have to, again, look at the question of why dark matter? And also, speaking about the universe, we know that the rovers on Mars are quite reliable. They've been able to hobble their way across tremendous deserts and craters, but they're extremely slow, and they're quite clumsy, and they can't navigate over, for example, the ice caps or rocky terrain. Why not have robot dogs? Dogs that can travel as fast as a human can run. Think about that. Artificial intelligence has now reached the point where we can create robotic dogs that, for the most part, can do what dogs can do. And so the question is, will robotic dogs eventually scan and begin the process of colonizing the red planet? And now let's say a few things about inner space as well. You know, common sense tells us that relatives tend to look alike. If you don't believe me, just look at your own family tree, brothers and sisters and cousins. It's common sense. But the question is, why? Are there genes which can show this? Well, there's a new study being done to isolate the relationship between facial features and genes by scanning 8,000 individuals and using advanced computer programs to isolate where and how DNA may influence our face and what we look like. This, of course, has enormous implications, medical implications, also implications for crime detection, and then it also raises ethical questions. What happens if we can modify those genes to change the way we look? Will everyone want to have children that look like movie stars? Well, you had to think about that. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The lead story today is that, well, yes, there are some hiccups, and it's happening much slower than expected, but vaccinations are now being given out. And of course, there's all these ethical questions about who gets the vaccine first, but it's nothing short of a miracle that in just the span of several months, we were able to go from the laboratory into the field with a vaccine that is 95% effective. However, there are lots of questions involved. First, we know that the seasonal flu, well, every year we have to get a new vaccine for the seasonal flu because it mutates. In fact, mutates quite rapidly, and that's why we have seasonal flu vaccination. Well, measles, on the other hand, does not mutate so rapidly. And so once you're inoculated for measles, it stays with you for the rest of your life. So the big question that a lot of people is asking are, what about COVID-19? How long does the vaccine work for? Well, the short answer is, we don't know. We've only had about 3 months worth of data concerning the first individuals ever to be vaccinated, so no one really knows. All we know is that the rate of mutation of the virus is much slower than the rate of mutation of seasonal flu. So there are some indications that perhaps the vaccine will be better than the seasonal flu vaccine, but of course that's just a hope. Now, the real danger is emerging from South Africa. First of all, the headlines blared the fact that a new mutation has surfaced in the United Kingdom, which is perhaps 70% more infectious than the standard coronavirus. Well, scientists analyzed that new virus and they realized that it's probably vulnerable to the vaccine that we have today. However, and this is now sending shivers up the spines of many a doctor, and that is there's yet another new mutation coming out of South Africa, which actually may be, who knows, invulnerable to the vaccine. Now, how do we know that? Well, it turns out that the way in which the virus enters your lung cells is by attaching one of its spikes on the surface onto your cells and injects its genetic material into your cell. These are called spike proteins. You've seen images of the virus. It looks like spikes coming out of a ball. These are called spike proteins, and they're like the key that then hits and inserts itself into the lock guarding a cell. The protein then turns the key, opening up the cell for infection. It turns out that this new virus coming out of South Africa has many mutations in the spike protein. Now, that doesn't mean that it'll evade the vaccine. It just means that if it has the correct mutations, and there are quite a few of them in this new strain, perhaps some of those mutations will evade the vaccine. Because you see, that's what happens when the virus hits your cell. The lock is penetrated by the key. But it turns out that with this new variation coming out of South Africa, it has a different key, more mutations in that key, meaning more ways in which it may be able to gain entrance to your cell and evade the vaccine, which retards the cells, retards the virus's ability to insert the key into the lock. Well, the short version of all this is that we're waiting to see whether or not this new virus is as deadly as some people fear it might be. And speaking about fears, yet another fear is emerging in the Middle East, where we have the bomb potentially proliferating to some of the most volatile regions, specifically Iran. It turns out that, well, under President Barack Obama, a treaty was negotiated. The Iranians stopped its enrichment program. But then President Donald Trump pulled out of the treaty, and the Iranians just announced that they're going to go for 20% enrichment. Now, let me explain. In order to get bomb-grade uranium, you have to have U-235, which is a type of uranium which is quite rare. Most uranium, like found in ore, is U-238. So you have to separate the useless U-238 from the volatile U-235, which is the stuff of atomic bombs. How do you do that? Well, first of all, you purify uranium ore, and then you make it into a gas, uranium hexafluoride, and then you spin the gas in an ultracentrifuge. In the ultracentrifuge, the heavier isotopes go to the bottom, and the lighter isotopes go to the top. And then you can just remove the top layer. The top layer has enriched U-235 because it is lighter than U-238. And then you repeat this process over and over and over again until you hit 90% enrichment, meaning 90% U-235, 10% U-238. That is bomb-grade uranium. And how much bomb-grade uranium is necessary to wipe out Hiroshima? About the size of your fist. About 20 pounds of this very heavy metal is sufficient to flatten a modern city. And then the question is, can the Iranians then build an atomic bomb? Well, at the present time, the answer is no. But then the next question is, how long will it take to break out? Let's say that they announce that 20% is not enough and they're going to go for 90%. How long will it take for them to reach 90% enrichment? Well, the short answer is, we don't know. They have plenty of ultracentrifuges ready to go if they get the go-ahead. Maybe a year. Nobody knows for sure because we don't know the state, really, of their enrichment process. Some of the enrichment facilities are, in fact, secret. And so who knows how long it will take for them to reach breakout. But there's also another danger. Not just breakout within a year, but let's go into the future, 10, 15 years into the future, after a hypothetical treaty is expired. At that point, there are no restrictions on the Iranians at all. Yes, even with a revived treaty with Iran, they can get as much uranium as they want after the treaty expires. So in other words, there's a hidden clause in the treaty that basically says that they have the right to be a nuclear power with nuclear bombs after the treaty expires. Well, that's a lot to swallow. So we'll have to wait and see what the next administration does about nuclear weapons proliferating into the most volatile region on the planet Earth. And speaking about mysteries, let's say a few things about dark matter. You know, every high school textbook says that the world is basically made out of atoms, and these atoms in turn can be arranged in the periodic chart of elements. Well, boy, were we wrong. First of all, we now know that most of the universe is not made out of atoms, and the atoms that we do have do not represent dark matter. Dark matter is perhaps 10 times more plentiful than ordinary matter. And beyond that, dark energy is many times more plentiful than dark matter. So we are the oddballs. The atoms of your body, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, the atoms of your body make up about 0.01% of the matter-energy content of the universe. We are the oddballs. And to be very frank, from a physics point of view, we are basically made out of nuclear waste from the burning of stars. Well, the question is, what is dark matter and how do we know it exists? It turns out that astronomers like Vera Rubin years ago noticed that the Milky Way galaxy was spinning 10 times too fast. According to Newton's law of motion, a galaxy spinning that fast would fly apart. But you see, our galaxy is quite stable. In fact, when we look at other galaxies in the heavens, they all spin approximately 10 times too fast, and they don't fly apart. They're quite stable for billions of years. And so astronomers said, aha, rather than throw out the laws of Isaac Newton, there must be a new form of matter, dark matter, which surrounds the galaxy and keeps the galaxies intact. That's called dark matter. It is invisible. So if you had dark matter in your hand, for example, because it doesn't interact with atoms, the dark matter would sift right through your fingers as if your fingers were made out of ghost material. And dark matter would then hit the floor, go right through the concrete, right through the core of the Earth, right to China, where it would reverse direction and come back to the planet, through the core of the Earth, back to, let's say, New York City. And then it would oscillate just as if the Earth weren't there at all. So dark matter is very strange. It's invisible, it has mass, but it doesn't interact chemically with ordinary matter. That's why it's so difficult to find it. And right now, there are many teams around the Earth looking for the signature of dark matter collisions, which will create a spark in a spark chamber, and they're hoping to win the Nobel Prize by detecting dark matter in a laboratory. Well, to be honest, there is another rival theory. The other rival theory is not as popular as the dominant theory, which says that it's just a new particle. This dominant theory says that, well, maybe Newton was wrong. Maybe Einstein was wrong. Maybe the laws of gravity out to the edge of our galaxy is not simply the inverse square law, which every child learns when they learn about Newton's law of gravity. Maybe there's a kink in the attraction of gravity at large distances, galactic distances, which has never been conclusively measured. And recent data seems to support this. So the proponents of this theory say, aha, recent data seem to support the idea that maybe Newton and Einstein, they were both wrong. However, it's still, let's be honest, a minority point of view. Data will still come in, and then and only then will we be able to say what dark matter really is. Now, let me say right now that I have my own prejudice as to what dark matter is. I think dark matter is a higher vibration of the string, and that is everything around us is nothing but music, musical resonances on tiny little vibrating strings, and these strings can vibrate in different octaves, and the next octave is supersymmetric, matter, particles that are different, have different properties as to the ordinary matter that we see around us. And the candidate is called the photino. A photino is a new vibration of the string. It is massive. It has weight, interacts with gravity, but it has no charge. It has no electromagnetic interactions. And so it is the leading candidate so far for what dark matter is. Well, ultimately, of course, experiment will tell us who's right. Also, when you look at the rovers that roam across the surface of Mars, you realize that these rovers are giving us an unprecedented look at what the Martian terrain is. But let's face it, these rovers are clumsy, they're slow, and they can't go to the interesting areas like the polar ice caps, or the debris from a meteor impact crater. Places which are quite interesting, that's where rovers cannot go. This is where artificial intelligence comes in. Artificial intelligence has advanced so much now that we can create a robot dog. That's right. It can run, jump. It can do what a dog can do. In fact, you can push it over. You can push it over so it's on its back, and it'll right itself just like a real dog. And how fast can it go? It can go as fast as you can walk, about 3 miles per hour, which is 30 times faster than the Mars rovers that we have on Mars. Plus the fact that you can use artificial intelligence so the robot can make up its own mind where to go. It doesn't need remote control. It simply needs the permission to use artificial intelligence to then romp all over the surface of Mars. Now, why do we need a rover that looks like a dog? And the answer is quite simple. The dog can roam in caves. caves where rovers cannot go. Caves are important because we think that initially, the astronauts that go to Mars that have to stay there for months at a time may use caves as shelter against cosmic rays, the dust storm, radiation, a ready-made shelter in the form of caves. Not to mention the fact that the most interesting regions of Mars are forbidden from the rover because the rover cannot negotiate the ice-covered regions of the polar ice caps, and it cannot navigate the debris left by meteor impacts. And so in some sense, some of the most interesting features of Mars cannot be analyzed by the current generation of rovers. And that's where this new generation of rovers comes in. It looks like a dog. It has four legs. You can put cargo on its back like an ordinary dog. It can run, trot like a dog. It can do pretty much what dogs can do. And so it would make the ideal robot to roam the surface of Mars, looking for shelter, probing the terrain of the ice caps, looking at the geography of caves, and perhaps opening up Mars for exploration. Also, on the medical front, our DNA analysis of the human genome is getting so fine that we can now pick out certain genes that influence facial features. Think about that for a moment. Facial features are, of course, genetically related. We see that every time we look at our parents, our children, our cousins, our family tree. My God, they look like us. But what are the genes that control this? Well, for many a decade, it was simply too difficult to find those genes. But now scientists are beginning to make a breakthrough. First of all, recently 8,000 individuals had their genome sequenced. And then this information was run through a computer to correlate people's faces with the genes. Of course, this is an extremely crude process because there could be thousands of genes that are influenced. Influencing our facial features, not to mention the environment. But the computer found 130 sites on the chromosome that are very much linked to our facial features. Now, why should we care? Well, in crime detection, many a time you come up with a skeleton of a corpse, and there's no way to determine what that person looked like. But now, perhaps we'll have an inkling of what that person looked like by matching certain facial features to certain genetics that we can find in a DNA analysis. So crime detection could be revolutionized. Medical diagnoses could become much sharper in identifying why certain people have afflictions with certain facial features. But of course, it also raises some ethical questions as well. First of all, once we identify the genes that are correlated to facial features, at some point, somebody may be tempted to tamper with that and to influence that and maybe even market genes which can influence the way you look. Think about it for a moment. How much of your success in life and your life path is influenced by what you look like? Well, obviously, quite a bit. If you don't believe me, just go to any high school. And you can see the games that teenagers play with each other as they begin to realize that the way you look correlates often with your social status or the kinds of friends you have, the kinds of career opportunities that are open to you. There's a lot involved. And what happens in the future if you have the ability to alter some of these genes? Let's say, for example, hypothetically, a movie star goes to the barbershop and somebody surreptitiously collects some of the DNA and is able to sequence the genes of that movie star and able to then modify your children's genes so they begin to resemble that movie star. What happens if someone does this surreptitiously? In fact, illegally, because in the future, who knows, maybe you'll be able to patent or copyright your genome. and thereby legally sue somebody who tries to copy your facial features. But what happens if there's a black market? What happens if these genes are available on the internet and a black market forms? I mean, we have difficulties controlling the drug market today. Think of what happens when designer genes are available on the internet on a black market. Genes, for example, that influence your ability to do well in school, your attention span, your memory retention ability, your ability to manipulate abstract concepts. Maybe one of these days we'll find some of the genes for that, and maybe they'll be offered on the black market. Why the black market? Because maybe there are side effects, which are dangerous. But, and this is purely hypothetical, if you just found out that your child's neighbor that your child competes with has been genetically altered to become, quote, smarter, unquote, wouldn't that put pressure on you to genetically modify your kids because of a rumor that there's a smart gene going around? Well, you know, parents are genetically programmed. They can't help it. They're genetically programmed to give every benefit to their children. Piano lessons, special tutoring. That's why parents want their kids to try out for soccer to strengthen their muscles. I mean, think about it for a moment. Parents do all sorts of crazy things to enhance the genetic advantage that you get by being stronger, more studious, prettier, more handsome, what have you. And what happens if these genes become widespread? Well, you can imagine the chaos that could follow. But the good news is that's still a long ways off. We're just beginning to understand the correlation between the human body and the genome, and not to mention the fact that at the present time, genetic manipulation, that is gene therapy, is in its infancy. Progress in gene therapy has been very slow, and so gene therapy, except in a few cases, has been pretty much on the slow lane. And so don't think that science fiction stories about designer children is going to come about anytime soon. Well, that concludes the first part of our program. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku inviting you to stay tuned for the second half when we talk about, well, aliens in outer space. We're going to bring on our friend, Dr. Seth Shostak, who will talk to us about one day will we make contact with an alien civilization in outer space. And so once again, you're listening to Exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku. Stay tuned for the second half of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. First of all, if you want to know more about what I do, go to my website. It's mkaku.org, mkaku.org. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers. My latest bestseller is called The Future of Humanity. That is humanity once we explore outer space, once we go to Mars and beyond. And on my website, you can also find out what I do for a living. I work on something called string theory, which we think, though we cannot prove, is the fabled theory of everything. One equation from which you can derive all the physical constants, all the physics of the universe itself. Well, that's the dream anyway, the dream of a theory of everything called string theory. But in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Dr. Seth Shostak, an old friend of Exploration. He's the director of the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And recently they had a huge setback. The Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico collapsed. That was the workhorse of radio telescope astronomy and also the search for intelligent life in outer space. And unfortunately, there's simply not enough funds to build a new one, at least in the short term. So once again, we've had this tremendous setback, but that, of course, doesn't discourage people like Dr. Seth Shostak, who've been through many setbacks in the past, trying to get funds to look for alien civilizations in outer space by eavesdropping on their conversations. Well, Seth, let me ask you a question. And that is, when you eavesdrop on radio emissions from aliens, I mean, after all, there's so many possibilities, so many frequencies. How do you know? How do you know where and how to listen to eavesdrop on conversations between advanced alien civilizations? How do you do that?
Well, that's actually a good point because, of course, you know, the aliens haven't sent us a fax telling us where on the dial they might be broadcasting. So you have to sort of second guess what frequencies, what part of the dial makes sense. And that idea had already been explored, even though Frank Drake didn't know that, by a couple of guys who at that point were at Cornell University, a couple of physicists by the name of Giuseppe Cocconi and Philip Morrison. Anyhow, these two guys had already thought about what frequencies make sense if you're going to send messages between the stars. And they said, well, look, there's kind of a natural answer to that because there's one frequency everybody will know, and it turns out to be 1420 megahertz on the dial. You might think, well, what's special about that? It turns out that hydrogen, which is by far the overwhelmingly most common element in the universe, hydrogen naturally emits some radio emission at 1420 megahertz. So all astronomers, you know, of any sophistication in the universe will know about this frequency. So they said, look, that's a natural frequency. Everybody will have it marked on their radio dial. Let's try listening there. Frank Drake came to the same conclusion rather independently. And so the first experiments were done usually with a receiver that only had one channel, could only listen to one channel at a time, just like your auto radio, and set that frequency somewhere near this 1420 megahertz magic frequency on the dial. Now, as time went on, this kind of experiment became much more sophisticated. Today, the receivers that are used for SETI listen simultaneously to tens of millions of channels at once because, you know, you don't know exactly which frequency might be the one they're using, but they tend to look at still at that part of the dial around 1420 megahertz. Not always. Sometimes they'll do experiments where they're looking elsewhere, but usually you're covering maybe 1,000 or 2,000 megahertz around that frequency. So, you know, it's a small fraction of the dial, but it seems to be a pretty good one. No one's ever come up with a better argument about where to tune.
Okay, now let's talk about Drake's equation, which is taught in every elementary astronomy course as scientists try to get a reasonable scientific estimate of the probability of intelligent races throughout the galaxy. So tell us a little bit about Drake's equation.
Well, the equation actually has an interesting history, or at least semi-interesting. Frank Drake had done that first listening experiment in the spring of 1960. So, gosh, that's 45 years ago. It was in April, I think, 1960. Anyhow, so that generated a lot of interest. I mean, he didn't find the aliens, but it generated a heck of a lot of interest. And so the next year, he had a meeting, also in West Virginia, at the observatory, in which he invited all the kind of professional scientists who were interested in this work. That total was like 10 or 12 or something. It was mm-hmm. a fairly small number. And as an agenda, he was, you know, he's sitting around thinking, well, this meeting's coming up in a couple of weeks. I need an agenda. So as an agenda for this meeting, he wrote down this very simple equation, which has subsequently become known as the Drake equation. And all it does is try to estimate something called N, where N is the number of civilizations in our galaxy, just let's confine ourselves to our galaxy, that are broadcasting right now. The number of star systems, if you will, that are producing signals now that we could detect. Now, clearly, that depends on, well, how many stars are there in the galaxy, and what fraction of those have planets, and what fraction of those planets have produced life, and what fraction of those that have produced life have produced intelligent life, and what fraction of those have produced technology, and what fraction of those are actually on the air right now. Okay, so it's a whole string of terms. There are actually seven terms in the equation. You can find it in almost any textbook on astronomy, and that's the Drake equation. And it would be great because it would tell you, you know, what are your chances of success? I mean, if N is only a few, then the chances that you'll find these guys is pretty small. But if N are thousands or millions or some very large number, Carl Sagan thought that the value of N was several million. Well, if that's true, then, you know, you have a pretty good chance of tripping across a signal sooner or later. So, unfortunately, of course, we don't know what N is. There are a bunch of terms in the equation that we simply don't know. So it's more of a talking point kind of thing than it is an equation that you can actually solve or use.
Other scientists say, bah, humbug. We had Professor Brownlee on our airwaves about a year and a half ago, and he said that Drake's equation is flawed. Flawed because there are new astronomical bits of information that show that, well, to get life is more difficult than we thought. He mentions, for example, that you need a large moon. Without a large moon, the Earth would eventually tumble in its orbit and over hundreds of millions of years, and that would make DNA impossible. He also mentioned the fact that at one point the entire Earth was frozen over. We were snowball Earth. And again, DNA would be very hard to get off the ground under those circumstances. He mentions you have to have a large Jupiter in order to clean out the debris of the solar system. He also mentions you have to be a certain distance from the center of the black hole at the center of the galaxy. Otherwise, you get fried by being too close to this very radioactive core at the center of the galaxy. But if you're too far out, then there are not enough heavy elements to create DNA and higher molecules. So, well, what are your thoughts? Is the Earth in some sense unique, as Professor Brownlee was hinting at? Or do you think N is quite large, as Carl Sagan believed?
Well, of course, nobody knows, so everything I'm going to tell you is my opinion on this,
okay.
Obviously.
Good enough.
If we knew the answer, we wouldn't be discussing it, but it's true. Don Brownlee and his colleague Peter Ward at the University of Washington up in Seattle wrote this book about 5 years ago called Rare Earth, in which they had indeed, as you indicated, kind of a laundry list of reasons why Earth might not be just a run-of-the-mill planet. Earth might be very, very special, so special that, in fact, although there might be some other life out there, it's not going to be very sophisticated life. It isn't going to be intelligent life. And so our SETI experiments are kind of a waste of time. That was their thesis. And since this was reviewed, by the way, in the New York Times, this book got a lot of play. But if you actually look at this laundry list, you find that the items on it are not terribly convincing. Let's take a couple of the ones you named, for example. The fact that the Earth has a large moon, which kind of stabilizes the spin of the Earth. Okay. Now, if we didn't have that large moon, and by the way, a large moon is kind of a rare thing. You know, Mercury doesn't have a large moon, has no moons. Venus doesn't have a large moon, has no moons. Mars has a couple of moons you could walk around in an afternoon. Tiny moons, they don't help. Earth, on the other hand, among the rocky planets, is the only one to have a large moon. Okay. And sure, it does stabilize the Earth's spin. But if you took that moon away, the Earth wouldn't, just go completely nuts. Every now and again, the North Pole would come down to, Connecticut or some other place, that sort of thing. But it would take hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years to do that, right? So it's such a slow event that even, for complicated life like freshwater otters or whatever, right, they can just walk away from that problem. If you've got 100,000 years, before the North Pole gets to you, you have plenty of time to move. I mean, that isn't fatal to life. That's not fatal. It might be an inconvenience, if you had a society with a lot of cities, you might not want it to happen. But it's so slow, it's not fatal. Now, here's another thing in your list there. You mentioned we're fortunate to have Jupiter because Jupiter has cleaned out the inner solar system of all these big rocks that otherwise might, slam into your planet and ruin the whole day just the way it happened 65 million years ago, taking out the dinosaurs and 75% of all other species. Well, sure. But on the other hand, big Jupiters are not rare. We know that. In fact, all the planets we've found around other stars are like Jupiter are bigger. Right? So big planets are not rare, but even aside from that, you could argue that maybe life on Earth would have gotten a little bit farther had we not had such a big planet as Jupiter out there, because, in fact, you know, if the dinos had been wiped out 50 million years earlier, we would be 50 million years ahead of where we are today. We'd have the cure for death, whatever, you know. It would be, maybe we'd be better off. So I don't find that a very convincing argument. I mean, you can look at each one of these arguments. The snowball Earth, yes, there's some evidence, although it's somewhat controversial, but there's some evidence that there was a time a few billion years ago when the entire Earth was encrusted with ice. But there was life on Earth then. And that life wasn't wiped out by snowball Earth. It just, you know, had to sit there and, you know, live at the bottom of the oceans for a while. But, you know, a lot of life, well, all life was down in the oceans anyhow. So, you know, it didn't wipe out Earth. It wasn't fatal. Okay, so all these things, yes, they might be an inconvenience or they might not be. But in any case, none of them stopped life on Earth. None of them stopped life on Earth. So I really don't think that Earth is really all that special.
Well, Professor Brownlee goes on, in fact, on and on and on, as I found out interviewing him. He also says that microbial life could, in fact, be quite common throughout the universe, but intelligent life. Well, take a look at the dinosaurs, he says. You know, we've had life forms with spinal cords and nervous systems for hundreds of millions of years on the Earth, but humans, only humans on the Earth, even on the Earth with such ideal conditions, it took hundreds of millions of years for that, for humans to get off the ground. And even then, there were many times when humanity may have been wiped out. There were only a few thousand of us, 100,000 years ago to create the entire human race. The human race could have been wiped out many times during certain bottlenecks in our evolution. So he was basically saying that intelligent life is extremely rare, even if you have microbial life being common. What are your thoughts?
Well, he's right in that this is a controversial area. I think even more controversial than the question of whether you can get complex life on a lot of planets. I don't think that's so controversial myself. But just because I give you a million planets with life, right, and you let them cook for a few billion years, there is a legitimate question. What fraction of them will ever cook up something as clever as, you know, as we are? And we are clever compared to the most critters around, right?
That's debatable, but anyway.
Well, but in any case, I mean, you know, we don't know because we still don't understand fully how, or even partially really, how intelligence evolved on Earth. What was it that produced intelligence on Earth? If it's a mechanism that was just very rare in the sense of being accidental or contingent upon a lot of special circumstances, then maybe he's right. Maybe you got lots and lots of life out there. Maybe Captain Kirk takes the Starship Enterprise out into space and finds lots and lots of life in the galaxy, mm-hmm. but it's all stupid.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
That's one possibility. But on the other hand, all the studies that have been done about how intelligence arose on Earth suggest that, well, what drove it was nothing that you wouldn't expect elsewhere. And sure, it took a long time before you got this far, but you needed some preconditions. You needed warm-blooded animals with a high metabolic rate. You know, you needed all sorts of biological developments. And then, in the last 50 million years, which, of course, is fairly short in the history of the planet, but in the last 50 million years, a lot of species have gotten smarter. Obviously, Homo sapiens, but, you know, and obviously our simian relatives, right? Chimps are pretty clever. But, you know, birds are pretty clever. Even octopi are fairly clever. Whales and dolphins are fairly clever. There's been an increase in intelligence among, you know, a couple of handfuls of species in the past 50 million years. It isn't just one species that got smarter. Now, we got smarter than they did, but if you were to visit Earth 2 million years ago, you would have found that the smartest things on the planet were not our simian ancestors, but some white-flanked dolphins. They had the highest IQs. And they didn't leave a lot of literature, but, you know, they were the smartest things around.
Mm-hmm.
So it does seem that intelligence is actually kind of a fairly natural product of evolution once you get to a certain level of complexity. This is controversial, but at least the indications are that intelligence is not some sort of miracle.
Okay, well, shifting gears a little bit, we also had Professor Dan Wertheimer from the University of California at Berkeley on our airwaves a few years ago talking about SETI at home. That is, on your home PC, you can get a chunk of this radio data and have your PC via its screensaver basically crunch some of the numbers to look for intelligent signals. What's been the progress for SETI at home in the last several years?
Well, SETI at Home was intended originally just to be a very short-lived project, maybe for a year or two. But it was so popular that it's continued. They expected, you know, maybe 50,000 people would download this free bit of software so that when they walk away from their computer, you know, it's still humming away, that it would process a certain amount of SETI data that it would download from the servers at the University of California at Berkeley. Well, more than 5 million people have downloaded that software. Mm-hmm. So that's you know, that's 100 times as many as they expected, and about a third of them use it at any given time. What they do is they distribute a little bit of the data they collect from the radio telescope down in Puerto Rico, the Arecibo radio telescope, which a lot of listeners may have seen in the movie Contact, movie GoldenEye. You know, it's a great movie star. Yeah, they distribute about 1 or 2% of the data they collect there on the web for people using the screensaver. But the point is that there are so many people doing this with their home computers that it is by far the largest computer project, the largest computer, if you will, in the world right now. And those data are looked at extraordinarily carefully. So, you know, it's really a very, very fine-tooth comb. They look at all the rest of their data right there at Berkeley using, you know, the local Berkeley computers, but they can't look as carefully as they can at this small fraction of the data, which, you know, are the prime data, if you will. Now, has anybody found something? Well, people find stuff all the time, of course. If you do these sorts of work, and you're using a big antenna like the one in Puerto Rico, you find signals all the time. After all, you got this huge antenna. It's connected to a receiver that has millions of channels. Of course you pick up signals. But, of course, the question is that ET on the line, or is that AT&T on the line? Is it just interference from a telecommunications satellite or something like that? Now, what the guys at Berkeley do is they look at all the signals that have been found by people using their computers at home, and they look for those cases where a signal has been found more than once, in fact, more than twice. If a signal has been found three different times, right, not just by three different people, that doesn't count, but by, you know, at three different times. In other words, the telescope was pointing at some spot on the sky, and they find a signal, and then, you know, 3 months later comes back to that same point, and somebody else finds it again at that same frequency, at that same spot on the sky. If that happens three or more times, then they say, hey, look, that's, you know, kind of interesting from a statistical point of view. That suggests it's not just a noise spike. That's, you know, looks like a real signal. And then they will go down to the telescope and will deliberately look at that spot on the sky for a long period of time, for a few minutes, whatever it takes, until they can verify whether the signal's still there. They have done that on several occasions. So far, no dice. But on the other hand, it is quite possible that somebody running SETI at home could, in fact, find the signal that would entitle them to pick up a prize in Stockholm and have dinner with a king.
And that, of course, would be perhaps one of the pivotal events in human evolution on the planet Earth.
I think so.
Well, let me ask you now the $64,000 question. What do you, as an individual, think N is, N being the number of intelligent planetary systems out there, and where are they?
Yes, well, of course, I don't know what N is either, but I tend to agree with Frank Drake, who still works here at the SETI Institute. His office is down the hall from mine. And you know, Frank is now, I guess he'll be 75 in another month or so, but he's still as active as he ever was. And he's a pretty smart guy. He's one of the cleverest guys I've known. And if you ask Frank, look, you know, this is your equation, what do you think N is? He'll say, well, I think it's probably around 10,000, which is kind of a conservative number compared to Carl Sagan, who thought it was a few million. I think Isaac Asimov thought it was 2/3 of a million. You know, so Frank is saying about 10,000. Well, if it's anywhere between 1,000 and, well, some bigger number, if it's more than 1,000, then that means that the nearest aliens are within on the order of 1,000 light years, okay, to us. Now, keep in mind that if you look at the whole Milky Way galaxy, it's about 100,000 light years across. So this is, you know, only like 1% of the way across the galaxy. 1,000 light years. That's far if you're trying to drive it in your Honda, but it isn't so far for a radio telescope. If that's the case, and it really is, you know, it's up for grabs. Obviously, we don't know. But if that's the case, then our experiments should find a signal within the next 20 years, because within the next 20 years, we will have kind of searched stars out to that distance. So that's my bet. But on the other hand, we're not going to know the answer until we know the answer.
And what are your thoughts about, well, where are they? SETI so far has picked up nothing. Is that just a question of lack of sensitivity of the SETI antennas, lack of detectors, or is it because they're shy out there in outer space, or maybe they don't exist? Or, well, what are your thoughts about why we haven't picked up any messages yet?
Yeah, well, this you know, I think that the answer is very simple. I think it's simply because we've not combed enough galactic real estate yet. But, you know, there are people who say, no, the fact that you haven't heard anything yet means something. It means that they're not out there, because any society that was more advanced than ours, and most of them are going to be more advanced than ours. I mean, if intelligence really does occur on planets in a fashion that's not extraordinarily rare, then most of the societies out there will be much older than ours, because, after all, you know, we're the new kids on the block. The Earth has only been here for 4.5 billion years. The galaxy has been around for like 3 times that length of time. So most of the stars out there are older than the sun. So if they're really advanced, then they should have been able by now to maybe colonize big chunks of the galaxy. Who knows? They should have been able to spread around. They should have, you know, remote transmitters. They should be very easy to find, right? And the fact that we haven't found them sounds like some sort of paradox. In fact, this little argument is often called the Fermi paradox, because Enrico Fermi, the physicist, the Italian-American physicist, was the first to point this out over a lunch at, I think it was Los Alamos in 1950. But in any case, that's his argument. I don't think I buy into that. I don't think it's a matter of them being shy, being coy. Maybe some of them are shy. Maybe most of them are shy. But if only one society has a powerful transmitter out there, then we have a chance of success. I think the reason we haven't found them yet is that we haven't looked very carefully. And all of that is going to change in the next few decades, mostly because of the march of technology.
Well, my personal point of view is that if there's an anthill in the country and you're walking down this country road and you bump into this anthill, do you go down to the ants and say, I bring you trinkets, I bring you beads, I bring you nuclear energy and DNA technology, or perhaps maybe you step on a few of them?
Yeah, probably. I get phone calls just about every other day from people who have their own explanation of why we haven't heard anything, and it's usually because the aliens are put off by our environmental degradation and our, you know, threatening one another with war and all that sort of stuff. But indeed, I think that from their point of view, none of that matters terribly much any more than whatever wars the ants are getting into concern me. They don't.
Mm-hmm. Now, another stream of thought says that we're looking in the wrong place. For example, take a look at email. Email is compressed. Email is broken up and goes through many cities and then recombined at the other end. So if an alien civilization had even a primitive email system, and we were eavesdropping on it, we wouldn't hear much at all. The signals would be compressed in a way that we don't understand. They'd be fragmented and redistributed and reassembled someplace else in a code we don't understand. So we could be listening in to messages that are teeming with intelligent things in it, but we are simply too primitive to understand it. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of truth in that. I don't expect that we are going to understand any of the messages, even to the point of being able to sort of break them up into the bits that that make them up. And it's also true that, you know, there are all sorts of methods for encoding information, for sending bits around that are fairly sophisticated that we use. For example, your cell phone tends to use what is called spread spectrum technology, where the signal is spread all over the dial instead of being concentrated in one spot. That's very hard to find with a radio receiver unless you know all the details of their communications schemes. So, yeah, there are lots and lots of ways they could make the signal hard to find, but in the end it comes down to this. If they have a transmitter on, that puts a certain amount of energy somewhere in the radio dial, somewhere in the radio spectrum. And we don't worry about how it's encoded or what the message is or anything like that. We don't worry about the message. When we do our SETI experiments, we're just trying to determine, is a transmitter on? We're looking for narrowband components to the signal, it's called, a little, you know, lots of excess energy, if you will, at certain spots on the radio dial. If we find that, we, of course, don't know what they're saying, whether it's something profound or whether it's something trivial like used car ads. We don't care about any of that. We're simply looking for evidence that their transmitters are on, because, after all, that's the proof that we're after.
Okay, now let's talk about flying saucers. Of course, the distances between stars are enormous. It would take the Voyager spacecraft thousands and thousands of years to reach the nearest star. But that's because, you know, we're kind of primitive on this scale that we're talking about. Another civilization could easily be a million years ahead of us. And so the next question is there a law of physics preventing a civilization millions of years ahead of us from making contact with us? Is there any brick wall that prevents an advanced civilization from making contact?
Well, Michelle, you're the physicist, and you mm-hmm. know that there isn't. There's
That's
no
true.
Physics that prevents it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may be some physics that makes it very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Conventional physics, if you use, you know, rockets in the normal sense, the problem there is our rockets, of course, don't go fast enough, but, you know, they're more advanced. They can build better rockets. But when you get up to very high speeds, and you really do need speeds that are comparable to the speed of light if you want to get from one star to the next in less than a century, which sounds to me like something you might want to do no matter who you are.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Well, once again, our special guest today was Dr. Seth Shostak, director of the SETI Project, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence in Outer Space. And, well, let me give you my own personal point of view. I personally think that, well, they're out there. I mean, there are 100 billion stars in our own backyard, the Milky Way galaxy. And on average, we know that every star, on average, has a planet going around it, which means that there are probably billions, billions of Earth-like planets that are just like our own Earth. Now, that doesn't mean they harbor life. Perhaps they have microbial life. I mean, after all, the dinosaurs were around for 200 million years, and none of them, to our knowledge, ever perfected radio or the internet or learned calculus. And so we think that intelligent life could be quite rare in the galaxy, but there are so many galaxies out there, 100 billion galaxies that we can plot with the Hubble Space Telescope, that the odds that there are intelligent beings in outer space is, I think, close to 100%. Well, if you want to find out more about my work, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers, and I've hosted a number of science specials for the Discovery Channel, the Science Channel, and BBC Television. Good day for Exploration.